Thank you very much for the introduction. Good afternoon, everyone. Let me first thank the organizers for putting together this nice conference and for letting me speak here. So this is work that I'm doing in collaboration with Juan, Roger, and my advisor, Simon Tripst in Cologne. And we're trying to apply techniques of machine learning to discover quantum phases of matter, even if there is a fermion side problem. So let me motivate this a bit. We know that in many fermion systems, and especially in strongly correlated many fermion systems, there are many very interesting phases that occur. For example, there's superconductivity, which occurs in many electron systems if you dope away from half-filling, as is shown here in this Weiss diagram. If you're looking at frustrated magnets, there's a possibility of having quantum spin liquids, and these are very exciting states of matter, and we need some way of studying them. And our tool of choice to do this is quantum Monte Carlo. And so many of you know the regular Monte Carlo, but let me just give you a brief introduction of what the essence of quantum Monte Carlo is. So in quantum Monte Carlo, we're trying to map a quantum problem to a classical problem. And we're doing this because we want to study, for example, the partition function, which is the trace over the density operator. But this being a Hamiltonian, which includes non-commuting operators, we can't evaluate this trace directly if we're not in the energy eigenbasis. So what we do is we discretize this beta step here into a product of many smaller Hamiltonian slices, which gives you these kind of word line configurations, okay? And then the trace over the states is represented by having the degrees of freedom on one axis, and they evolve in what is now called imaginary time in these kind of word line configurations. And these we can use to calculate observables. So any observable that you like, you can calculate from this. There's only one problem, and that is that now if you're in a quantum setting, it might happen that you have to deal with negative weights. So in this expression for the operator, where you sum over expectation values of an operator within a specific configuration, and you weigh it with the weight of this configuration, you would want to use this weight as a probability for advancing your Markov chain in your configuration space. Now that doesn't work if this weight is negative, because then you can interpret it as a probability. But there is still a way of getting around this, and that is formally, you can say that it's not actually the weight that has the sign, but the sign of the weight is some kind of observable that I have to evaluate. Okay, so we take the sign, which is denoted as sigma of C in here, so that's the sign of the weight of the configuration C. We take it out of the weight, and then we interpret this expression up here as being an observable sigma times O, and this expression down here simply as being the expectation value of the observable sigma. And so this works because now we're dealing with a positive definite weight, and we can use this for our Monte Carlo procedure. However, this observable down here and also the one up here, they fluctuate very strongly. And in fact, it can be shown from a simple consideration that the average sign, so the average value, actually decreases exponentially. And what this means is that not only does the average sign decrease exponentially, but also the relative error increases exponentially. And that means that we would have to sweep exponentially long, which makes the use of quantum Monte Carlo pointless, because the whole merit of using Monte Carlo is that you can explore this exponentially large Hilbert space in polynomial time. So you definitely don't want to be at exponential scaling. Okay. So then we can think, well, if I have a procedure of taking out the sign, maybe I can just ignore it. Maybe it's not too important and it's just a technical artifact. But it has been known for a very long time that this is not true, and this is one of the classic examples to illustrate this. So we're looking at a doped Hubbert model on a 4x4 square lattice. And we're trying to see if this is in a superconducting state or not. So we study the superconducting susceptibility, which is up here on the y-axis, as a function of the temperature. And so we can see that if we ignore the sign in our sampling and in the evaluation of observables, then the susceptibility will start to grow, and there's a small bump, but then it will go down, so indicating that there's no superconducting order. Well, if we actually include the sign, we see that the susceptibility goes up. So it suggests that there is actually superconducting order. And we can conclude from this that the correlation functions definitely come out wrong, or they might come out wrong, and are unreliable if you ignore the sign. So that's a bit of a bummer. But Then we can ask, well, so maybe is there other ways to avoid the sign problem? And the first and simple answer is, of course, if we're in the energy eigenbasis, then there is no sign problem, because then we can just evaluate the density operator, and everything is fine. The problem is that usually our problem isn't formulated in the energy eigenbasis, and if it was, then we wouldn't use Monte Carlo, because then we already had the solution, right? So then finding the transformation from the energy eigenbasis to the simulation basis that we want to use is also an exponentially hard problem, because that is exact diagonalization. So that's also not a good idea. What we can do, however, and what is not excluded in this picture, even though the energy eigenbasis is the one that is sign problem free, that does not exclude the possibility of having other sign problem free bases. And in the past 20 years, there have been at least three possibilities shown, and they're all very nice. But it has also been shown that there's no general solution to the sign problem, because it appears to be NP-hard. So now we can either try to find new bases and keep on extending this list, or you can also try to take a different perspective on the entire problem. And this can be done either by constructing effective actions, which has successfully been done in this paper here, or what Simon and I did last year, we looked at entanglement entropies and how they relate with the sign problem, and this is also a fruitful route to go down to. But what Roger Kwan and Simon and I did now is we consider the perspective of machine learning on this whole problem and see if maybe there's a way to get around this. Now, this is building up on the work that Kwan showed this morning, so we're trying to use convolutional networks and combine them with our quantum Monte Carlo approach. And in particular, we're trying to use the immense success that machine learning had in image recognition. So this is an example from one of the very first successful neural networks used in image recognition, and we're trying to combine that with quantum Monte Carlo. So the network that we're using is shown here. So this is this is also a convolutional network. In contrast with the one that Juan showed, we're using one more convolutional layer and the max pooling in between. But this is just for, you know, this is one that is successful in classifying images like these, so where you don't only have zeros and ones or grayscale, but actually like try to identify objects out of this. And this is the architecture that we adopted for our problem. Now, we also need to have objects that we put into, because it's not obvious, you know, what is actually the image that we're trying to get out of our quantum Monte Carlo simulation and put into the neural network. And to explain what we use, let me take a brief detour to explain in one slide the quantum Monte Carlo flavor we're using. So we're using something called determinantal quantum Monte Carlo, which is very successful in studying a strongly interacting many-body system. And so the way it works is you have some test wave function, and you apply a large number of a large exponential of the Hamiltonian, and then if your test wave function has some overlap with the actual ground state of your system, you will end up at some point in this ground state. And so then we're going to do the procedure that I told you before. We're going to discretize this projection time into smaller time slices, delta tau. And then typically our Hamiltonian is given as the sum of a kinetic term and a interacting term. So this is usually quadratic, because it's the hopping. And then we have this quadratic term, which actually is a problem to evaluate. So we're going to decouple this interacting part using a Haber-Schrödinger field, which introduces these auxiliary fields right here. And I'm going to show you how this works. So let's say you have a density-density interaction, let's say in a spinful Hubbard model. So on some lattice side, which can be occupied by spin-up and spin-down electrons, you have this interaction term ni up and ni down. So so there's a penalty if it's double occupied. Then by applying this Haber-Schrödinger transformation, you're going to change your interaction term such that it now depends on the Haber-Schrödinger field, or variable in this case, which couples to the electrons on this side. And then we can do this for each of the sides that we have in our lattice to get a one-dimensional image. And then we also do this along each of the time slices in projection time, which then actually gives us this, what is already very suggestive of a two-dimensional image, and is what, and this is what is called the Happe-Zsigmond-Tronovich field. And then, you know, if we just put it together, you get this kind of pixel image right here. Okay. Now that is one option that we have for constructing images that we feed into a convolutional neural network. The other option is that, as Andy has told it this morning, a very central object in many body physics is the Green's function. And this Green's function has naturally two indices because it describes the process of inserting one electron at side J and then taking one out at side I and measuring how likely this is going to happen in the system, or what the amplitude is for this project, for this process. And so in the DQMC algorithm, we actually have access to this function very naturally. So there's no further computation that we have to that we have to perform. This just shows up in your sampling process. So this is very nice. And you know, this being with the two indices, we can also look at this as an image. And this already is more likely, you know, more reminiscent of an image that you would put into the neural network. Okay, so we're going to try these two objects that we're dealing with.
G has no translation invariance, right?
Sorry?
G doesn't have translation invariance because the field doesn't have.
Right, in this case it doesn't, yeah. Okay, now some examples. The models that we're going to study, they all live on the honeycomb lattice. So this is this lattice structure right here, which you probably have seen from the stuff on graphene. And we're going to work with a spinful Hubbert model. Its Hamiltonian is shown up here. So there's this hopping term, which allows the electrons to hop from side to side. And there's this interaction term, which penalizes if they are all on the same side. This model undergoes a phase transition at half filling from a semi-metal to a spin density wave, and this critical point has been studied extensively in the past. And so the nice thing about this is, as a test case, that there's no sign problem at half filling. So we know everything about this, we know where this critical point is, and we can just do the simulation and see how well it performs. The other model we're going to do is we're going to take the spin index off our electrons. So we have now spinless fermions. These spinless fermions can't interact via an on-site interactions because they can't occupy the same lattice site. But they can interact via a nearest neighbor interaction, which is this V.
I'm afraid you said spineless fermions.
I did? Well, that's my autocorrect, what my Mac always does. It creeped into my mind. Sorry. So they are actually spineless because they have a sign problem and they do not emit any kind of Monte Carlo sampling. But nevertheless, we're going to see how we are going to, you know, beat some spine into them. So this also undergoes a phase transition from a semi-metal to a charge density wave this time. And so this point has also been studied in the past, or in the past 2 years, let's say, because it was found that this can actually be simulated sign problem free in a Majorana basis. But we're not going to do that because we explicitly want to have a very strong sign problem, which this has in the usual basis. All right, so let's see how this works with the Happe-Zsigmond-Tronovich field. So when doing a Happe-Zsigmond-Tronovich transformation, you always have the freedom of decoupling in a different channel. So this is very close to, let's say, mean field theory. So we can couple to the magnetization. We can also couple to the charge. These two differ in the way that they interact with the SU2 symmetry of the model. So coupling to the magnetization breaks it, but restores it when summing over all Happe-Zsigmond-Tronovich fields, while the charge one preserves SU2 explicitly. And then when you look at the fields, so we have chosen a transformation that gives you two valued fields. Okay, so it's just plus and minus one. In principle, you could choose fields that are four valued, so minus two, minus one, one, two. You could also choose a value per lattice site that is continuous, but this is the simplest one. But already here you see a striking difference. If you couple to the magnetization, then in the semi-metal phase, it's completely disordered. It just looks like a paramagnetic easing field. And this is also true for the charge-coupled Happe-Zsigmond-Tronovich field. But then when you look at the spin density wave state, then you see that, you know, this actually looks like word lines appearing in the direction of imaginary time, while it doesn't happen in the charge case. Okay. So now let's see what the neural network does with this. First, let's study the one that couples to the magnetization. What we did was we drew samples at extremal values of the interaction, so at u equals 1 and at u equals 16. Or in this case, it's actually u equals 0.1, so it's actually more extreme in the semi-metal phase. And we taught the neural network these two points, and then we predicted what happens along the development of when we change u by generating samples from a Monte Carlo simulation and feeding them to the neural network and letting the network decide what state we're in. And as you can see, the network is able to distinguish these two phases. That's good. But if you look at the scale at which the development or the prediction changes, it's really bad, right? So Juan told us that we should look at the point when the prediction is about 0.5, because that's when the network is maximally confused. And you see that this happens at around u equals 12 or 13, but it's way off from the critical point indicated by this line. Now, it gets even worse if you use the one that couples to the charge, because then, just as we are not able to distinguish anything from these two fields, also the net is not able to make out any distinction between these two cases. Now, that does not mean that in general Hubbard-Sultanovich fields could not be used for training. It's just in this specific case, it does not work. And actually, so having this ambiguity in what field you use, what channel you couple to, already tells you that maybe there's better objects to use. Also, and these are more technical points, if you're in a finite temperature simulation, then your Hubbard-Sultanovich field would change in size. But to avoid that, you would have to change your discretization step in imaginary time. So that's a little bit inconsistent. Plus, each coupling that you use, so if you have an on-site coupling and then you want to add a next nearest neighbor coupling, this will always enlarge your data set, because you would have a new field for each of these couplings, and this just makes your data larger and larger. So now let's look at the alternative, the Green's function, and I can tell you that already they do not suffer from these problems, so they are very, very nice to use. So this is what the Green's functions look like. They come out of the simulation as complex-valued matrices, and we visualize them here as taking the modulus as the color, so on the maximum color range, sort of going from red to blue, and then we use the phase of the complex number on each point as the saturation, so ranging from white to a bright color. And it's quite obvious that the semi-metal phase and the spin density wave phase and the spinfall honeycomb model are distinct. You know, it's possible to do this with the naked eye. This is again at u equals 1, and this is at u equals 16, so very deep in the mod phase. Now, if we train this, this is what we find. Okay, so again, we have on the x-axis we show the interaction. We have the prediction on the y-axis. This time, it made sense to draw the line where the prediction is at 0.5, so the intersection here would give you the critical point. I've indicated the points where we learned with red dots. We actually started learning at u equals 1 and u equals 16 and found the transition to be somewhere at 4.5 or something, and then we just moved closer because we felt that this was too far away from the interaction, from the transition. And then, so with the largest system size, L equals 15, we find about 4.1 as the critical value. This does seem far away. It's within 10% of the actual critical value here as the solid line. But then when you look back at the history of this model, you will see that in the first paper from 2010 that came out and said that, well, maybe there's a spin liquid in this model, they used exactly the same system sizes that we did, so up to L equals 15, and they found that antiferromagnetic order was only really measurable starting at U equals 4.3, and that's what this dashed line is here. And so with the critical value that we find, being within these two points somewhere in the middle, that's a very good result already. And then only, so let me just mention this, this paper here came out 2 years later. They studied sizes up to L equals 24, and they were also only able to move this line up to U equals 4. And then only, again a year later, they were actually able to find the real like to actually say that there's no spin liquid definitely in this model. So this is all fine within the finite size history of this model. Okay, but this was kind of to be expected because it doesn't have a sign problem. So if this didn't work, we'd be really unhappy. Now let's move on to a model that does have a severe sign problem, which is the spinless fermion case. Even despite the sign problem, we do know where the transition lies because, as I said, we can simulate it in the Majorana representations. There's also other Monte Carlo methods which are now able to do this. So it's thought to be at 1.35. And when you look at the data, we again trained at these extremal values. This time we didn't move closer because the data came out fine and there were no big oscillations as you did many epochs of training. You can actually see that there's some kind of finite size trend of approaching this transition. There's certainly a finite size effect. So L equals 15 on the honeycomb lattice is a moderately large lattice, but knowing that there's a strong finite size effect in the spinful case, it is to be expected that they carry over to the spinless case as well. But so here, even though we completely ignore the sign, so there's no notion of the sign even in our training, we're still able to distinguish these two phases, and we're able to find the transition point within relatively high accuracy. So that's very nice. Now finally, let's move on to a point where even the Majoranas can't help you anymore. So now we dope the spinless case away from half filling. And specifically, we dope it to a filling of 1/3. So now we don't have a semi-metal on the left, but we do have a Fermi liquid on the left. And on the right, there's also some kind of charge density wave, which is convoluted with some stripes. So it's like a stripy charge density wave state that we know from considering the case where there is no hopping, but only interaction. And so here we find that there's the transition roughly at 0.7, 0.8. And surprisingly, or maybe not so surprisingly, hopefully, this also matches up perfectly with entanglement data that we took before. So this is the case where, for those who know about the whole scaling of the entanglement entropies, this is the case where the log L correction to the boundary law vanishes, and there's just pure boundary law on the right side for stronger interactions. So this all works out perfectly. Now, as the last application of what we do, we're trying transfer learning, similar to what we saw earlier. So training your easing model on a square lattice and then evaluating the triangular lattice. But what we do is we train the spinful case, so where there's no sign problem, and we try to predict what happens to the spinless case. And this is because, so you can imagine that this might work because on the left side they both have a semi-metal, and on the right side one has a spin density wave, one has a charge density wave, and they appear to be structurally quite similar, okay? And so when we just take the network that we trained with the spinful data and try to predict the spinless data, then we find this, which, the transition, of course, stays at the same point. And we see that, again, we're roughly within 10% of that. Now, we would have hoped maybe that this would be better because just training on the spinless case and predicting the spinless case gave better results. But keep in mind that we always have these finite size effects. And we would have to look, what happens for larger lattices. Even just finding that the network is able to distinguish these two phases and distinguish them correctly is already quite amazing, I think. And so this brings me to my first conclusions. So we have shown that quantum Monte Carlo and machine learning approaches can be used quite nicely to distinguish many fermion phases. And also that the ensemble of Green's functions can be used even though we do have a strong sign problem. So this is very different to the calculation of observables. And now as a next step, we would like to take this idea also to other quantum Monte Carlo flavors, such as stochastic series expansion, and this is work in progress, but let me show you quickly. So if you take the transfer state easing model, which we have heard quite a lot about now, we don't use any kind of different couplings for different spins, but just uniform coupling all along. And we train on 4 points of the phase diagram, so deep in the magnetic phase, at low temperature, at high temperature, and then here we have a polarized phase, and then this is also, so these and these phases are the same, but we just took them separately and to see what would happen. then we can actually map out basically the entire phase diagram just from these four points. And just as a comparison on the right, I'm showing just the magnetization in Z direction, which is obtained from a usual SSE calculation that you get from calculating correlators. So this is quite amazing, and it's we're excited to see what's going to come out of this. So let me finish the conclusions. So the Green's function approach works very well, and now our vision would be that at some point we can use quantum Monte Carlo and machine learning as a tool to map out phase diagrams, just very generally, and see what phases we have, so that we can see which points are the most interesting to use, and maybe to treat with other methods that we have at our disposal. And so open challenges are definitely to improve this transfer learning, to maybe build a library of phases that we have, and we can just test these Green's function against a bunch of libraries or tests that we have. And then also try the unsupervised learning of fermionic phases and see what we have in there, what we can adopt, which techniques. Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Questions?
Yes.
In quantum Monte Carlo, sign problem is not the only problem, right? There's a class of problem which is sign problem free, but you have strong ergodicity issues.
Yeah.
But that kind of class of problem, because you have ergodicity issues, so you cannot really generate the snapshots or whatever that you want. So can
That's
you comment
true.
On that?
I think it's the same answer as in the talk before. If you don't have the data, then we can't train. So we'd have to look for more efficient algorithms. But at least in these fermionic models, there's so many models which do not seem to have ergodicity problems, but where the sign problem is really the limiting problem. Yeah.
If you could elaborate on this really quickly, I think I have just a general misunderstanding of the motivation.
Sure.
So it seems like for most machine learning projects or whatnot, that your input is difficult for a computer to read. Mm-hmm. So when you're inputting these phases, it seems like you can just calculate the order parameter of the phase, and all of this elaborate neural network stuff isn't necessary. So can you elaborate on maybe the advantages of this approach?
Yeah, so the problem is that for models with sign problem, you cannot evaluate any of the observables. So you don't know about the order parameter, and you have no idea what's going on. Your comment is of course true for the spinful case, because this has no sign problem and we know all the observables. But in other cases, we don't have access to any of the observables, and this would give us at least a schematic phase diagram showing here's phase A, B, C, D, and they're separated by these lines. Maybe it's even possible if you look at this to extract like critical exponents or something just from how these lines work. And yeah, there's a lot of work to be done, and it's definitely more useful for cases where you do have a sign problem as opposed to where you don't have a sign problem.
Thank you.
Hi, I think I forgot, where do you get your sample Green functions from?
Those are part of the algorithm. So every time that you try to update one of the auxiliary spins, so this algorithm samples the auxiliary fields, right? So the fermions don't appear anymore. And any time that you want to flip one of your spins or change it to a new value, you automatically access the Green's function, so entries of the Green's function. So there's no need to do any kind of additional calculation after sampling to get the Green's function. It's just in the algorithm. It's a part of it.
Okay, thanks.
Maybe to follow up on that, you don't encounter a sign problem when you generate your sample Green's functions to train on, because they're far away from a phase transition, or you encounter one, but you say
no. There's a severe sign problem. The average value of the sign is zero. Well, it's like 0.000. It's you would never have a chance of calculating any of the observables in this case.
But the Green's function works out. My question is how do you even get the data to train this stuff on a system with a severe sign problem? Because you need to create.
The equal time Green's function for free fermions moving in one specific configuration of the Hubbard-Stefanovich field. Okay. Right.
And you have to average over all of the Green's functions that you generated, weighted by the sign, and then divide by the average sign, which is itself very small. So your statistics are terrible.
That's correct.
The proposition here is that somehow machine learning can take this ensemble of generated Green's functions without a priori knowing which sign is attached to them,
right,
and extract useful information from it without averaging. So you need a much smaller set, a much smaller ensemble.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
Than you would otherwise. It seems absolutely miraculous that it works.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I also agree that it is miraculous that it's working. But when we calculate the observables, we have to take into account the sign. Here in the neural network, the way I think about it is that we are doing an optimization. We are finding a minimum. And it matters if we weight our samples differently in our generating samples. We know that if we have more samples at high temperatures, then the optimization is skewed. So here it seems to me that it's almost a similar situation where we are sampling based on the wrong probability, the absolute value of the probability. So even though it's not an observable, even though we are not calculating an observable, it seems like it should affect our optimization in non-trivial ways.
The appearance of the sign problem, you mean?
Generating the samples according to the absolute value of that negative probability, the probability that can be negative, right? So you're generating them based on that probability or modified probability, but then you are training your network.
So let's say we don't have a phase problem. I should say this in this case we even have a phase problem, right? So we don't just have plus and minus, but we have complex numbers which have to average out. And the way I think about this, let's say you only have a regular sign problem, okay? So you have your configuration space C, and you have configurations in them. It's plus minus, it's crazy, it's all over the place. You can rearrange your configuration space, right, to separate this into plus and minus. And so the same way you can write your partition function. This is a predictive algorithm, but partition functions work the same way. Into one that works over all configurations here, and one that works over all configurations here, we can calculate any observable like this. And then the point at which the sign problem really appears is that these two expressions will be almost of the same size, and doing this difference is really tough because it's on the last digits. So you have to sweep very, very long to actually find that. Now, we never do this average. We never do this sum. What we do is we tell the neural network, there's two classes. There's output 0, which is one phase, and there's output 1. And in output 0, please associate all the configurations from in here and all the configurations from in here. So we basically tell the neural network that to one of the features it learns, or one of the labels it learns, there's actually a class of two different objects. It's like teaching a network to distinguish between animals and cats, animals and cars, but animals comprise cats and dogs, and cars contains, Mercedes and BMW. And each of these classes, this is a cat and this is a dog, they're not the same, but the network just knows, okay, they're different from VW and or Mercedes and BMW. So we never actually do the averaging process, and the point at which the sign problem kills you is where you try to do averages, and we never do averages. And so we don't also need this exponentially large number of samples, because even if you evaluate these two, you can get a pretty good error bar on them just by using a few samples. But the error bar is just not small enough to actually allow you to do this sum correctly. And since we, or this difference, and since we're not performing this difference, it doesn't matter that we don't take exponentially many samples. In this case, we took 8,192 for each of the two phases. So that's tiny compared to what you usually need to get very small error bars.
Okay, maybe one last question if no one has a question. Okay, then let's thank all the speakers again this afternoon.